I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with composer Paul Sanderson and it's a wonderful chat. I'm sure so many of you would have seen Paul's recent work. He's scored the music for Earth, the big BBC One television show hosted by Chris Packham. It's a glorious thing to watch visually, and Paul's work with the audio, it's scored beautifully. So please go and check that out at the end of this episode. But before we get on with my chat with Paul, I just want to say thank you to everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network, which is headed up by my friend and podcast super star, Mr. Scroobius Pip. I'd also like to thank the team at Blue Murder Club. It's a true crime podcast. The team over there produced this episode, so thank you to them. When you get to the end of today's episode, why not explore the back catalogue? Because I imagine some of you have just headed over today that are fans of Paul that may never have heard an episode of this podcast before, and there's over 500, so you can go and get stuck straight in. So I urge you all to, at the end of this episode, go and explore that back catalogue. And even for the casual listener or the long-time listener, I'm sure there's episodes out there that you've missed. If you haven't, and you're thirsty for even more content, why not access a vault of hundreds and hundreds of episodes and radio shows and playlists and video episodes. You can watch all the video episodes. And I'm talking about my Patreon, which is a way that you can support this podcast and all of the things that happen in and around it. And it's going to cost you about 70p a month. We're experiencing a cost of living crisis in the UK at the moment. And so I know that myself and the people that I surround myself with, you know, everybody's having to be a little bit more careful with their pennies. So I've tried to keep this super reasonable. You look at most people's Patreons and they're 5, 10, 20 quid a month, and I've kept mine at 70p, which I think it's a dollar. That's what I'm saying, I guess. And so for that, you get all of that stuff that I mentioned, a huge vault of stuff. But most importantly, there's two things I want to tell you about. The first thing is, most importantly, it supports this podcast and it supports me constantly putting out these episodes for free. So, you know, any support you can give, it really will be appreciated. And secondly, also, that 70p doesn't just give you access to all the video episodes, all the back catalogue, all the radio shows. It also gives you a free ticket to the monthly live show on Zoom, where you get an opportunity to talk on a podcast and be part of the podcast and be part of this lovely circle of people that have become Patreons. And we do this little hangout once a month and we pick a little topic and we have a lovely chat for an hour. And it's one of my favourite things each month. And so I'd love more of you to come and experience that. You don't have to have your camera on. It's on Zoom. You can have your camera off and you can just, you know, listen in, or you can be really involved if you want to. It's up to you. But it's a lovely little thing. I mean, there's a couple of episodes that I've released on here. So go and have a listen. And yeah, I'd love you to support the podcast and come and be even more, you know, more of a part of it, and come and get your dulcet tones on an episode. Anyway, you can find out about that at Patreon, facebook.com/offthebeatandtrack, or just head to the website or any of the social media platforms, and there's links to everything over there. And the website is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. It's beat and, not beaten. offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Anyway, I know why you're here, and it's not to hear me pitching me Patreons. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beaten Track Podcast with the delightful Paul Sanderson.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Okay, we are recording. Paul, how are you today?
I'm great. Yeah, really good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, just before I've pressed record, you've showed me around your home studio, which is an amazing space. And before we get on to your song list, did you have that space there during the lockdown?
Yes. So it sort of, it was one of those things where built it, I think, like a year and a bit before all that happened. And you know, when we all got shut down, it was like, what? Like I had so many friends who were renting spaces in town, and obviously I was being told don't go anywhere, and then I was just traveling basically to the bottom of my garden to my home studio, and so I could continue as normal in a way. So it was such a blessing to have this space. Like, how was I to know that was going to happen? And yeah. It's amazing how now, since the pandemic, how like the sort of people in the business of making these garden buildings or garden studios suddenly just went up, and yeah, it was like, yep, yeah, that's a great idea to have. And yeah, it was honestly, it really came into its, into its element there.
Absolutely.
I was really lucky.
Absolutely. And the reason I ask is because I've got something, more of a kind of sort of podcast studio really sort of set up at the end of my garden, and I'm not in it at the moment actually, but over lockdown it enabled me to, and also because over lockdown all of a sudden everything moved to this thing called Zoom that we'd never heard of before, that we're sitting on now, that I totally wish I would have took shares out in about 4 years ago.
Is quite amazing that, like, I mean it was being used, but in a very business sense, I understand. And it's kind of this whole method of working, I think it's allowed, definitely I've seen it anyway in the area that I work in, this there's now no problem working across like the continent, across the pond, remotely. And people, like, in turn, while it being really useful, those who are either working in an office or working in production, their schedules get so tightly packed that then once before they come to your place and they're like, oh, we haven't got time, like, can we just jump on Zoom? And there's suddenly this we don't need to do Zoom anymore because we can be there in person. Yeah. And even spotting sessions, always being asked, oh, so do you want to be here in person? Like, yeah, like, we don't, yeah, please, like, I don't, absolutely, we don't need to separate. And but it's one of those things where it's probably made people even more busy because now no one has to go anywhere, so we just cram pack our days, but then it has made other things much easier and facilitate a kind of workflow.
Completely. I mean, this very conversation, we had to reschedule this one, and this, that's just for me and you to press open on our laptop. Whereas, pre-pandemic, it would have been lots of back and forth, right? Okay, do I come to your studio? Do you want to come to my studio? How are we going to do this? And then theoretically, we're going to lose half a day of travel and to capture this conversation. So,
It's a day affair. It's like a
There's pros and cons to it, and don't get me wrong, I do miss the feeling of being in a room with someone, because I do think that, without sounding like a crazy hippie, there you do get something extra from that. You do feel that the ambience of the room, whatever it is, like body language, but I think that when I, the first time I ever recorded one of these over Zoom in, early on in the lockdown, I was like, well, this is never going to work. You know, this is, we're all going to be speaking over each other and it's just not going to work. And it's amazing as humans how we adapt to what we're allowed to do and what we can do. And within literally, you know, two episodes, I was like, whoa, hang on a minute. I can keep myself sane during lockdown, because one of the sad things for the industry, and I work in the nighttime industry, and that was a standstill. You know, acting wasn't happening, music, like gigs stopped, you know. And so it was like, well, all of these people, actors, like, they're not working, so they've still got things to say. So it just meant, right, okay, well, I'm going to use this Zoom thing and I'm going to get to speak to people I was never going to get to speak to. Oh, hang on a minute, I can do it with people that live in other countries. This is amazing. And it just opened up something completely different.
Well, that's the facilitator of it. Like, I was asking my cousin is a songwriter, and, you know, he does a lot of writing sessions, songwriting sessions over Zoom. And I was like, how does that work? Because obviously Zoom, you know, is very cleverly blocks out background noise. Mm. And if you're trying to sort of vibe, like, I can imagine that being quite difficult. But, you know, he sort of said that actually, again, it sort of allows that time to, if they're kind of working up an idea, whoever's like producing the track, wherever they are, everyone can kind of just come off Zoom. That can, people then kind of for half an hour continue and then come back on again, and not all kind of be in the same room and be like, oh, can you just, like, I'm trying to write some lyrics here, can you just pause the track for a minute?
Yeah.
It's distracting, you know. And it's sort of I didn't really think about it that way. So yeah, but it has been able to connect people far and wide, wherever you are, you know, at like a click of a button, as you were saying.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's you know, it's, we work it into our new way, you know, bring it into our new way of working. And it is amazing.
Okay, Paul, let's start your playlist, and I'm gonna ask you to track one to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Firstly, I just want to say, from all of these, my answers, I thought the best way is do first reaction, initial, don't think too much about any of these, go. And I'm going to say The Final Countdown by Europe.
Okay.
Purely because, you know, like, the intro is about a minute and a half long. Like, modern pop records now are about 2.5 minutes long. I think even the middle eight's been scrapped. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, when you do an intros round, you hear that, you know what it is.
Yeah.
And it has this whole cinematic synth theme, you know, and that is actually kind of the chorus in a way. Yeah. And it's and I always had it, you know, I was doing a lot of running in my fast time just to kind of, you know, stay sane. But it's like, if I was running a race, that would be like track one that I put on my playlist to be like, right, here we go, come on, come on. And you feel like you're sort of in this kind of alternate 80s reality of you know, I don't know, it's just one of those uplifting tracks. It's such a power track.
Yeah.
But I just think the intro is, God, I don't think we get away with doing a minute and a half intro.
Not in a million years. And that was, you know, that was a global number one record, you know. And
yeah.
And I, because obviously the playover is the key to that track, you know. And
yeah.
But that doesn't, am I right in saying that doesn't come right at the very beginning?
What, the main bit? Yeah, well, no, it starts with, it's like a tease.
Yeah.
Because it starts with just this synth kind of hit that rises. Like, it's winding up.
Yeah.
And why it's interesting that you can, as soon as you just hear the first one, you're like, yeah, I know what this is.
Yeah.
And then it comes in just with this theme. And then it goes again, and the drum kit then come in.
Yeah.
And then it vamps for a bit. It's like the lead singer's like, just, yeah, I'm not quite ready yet. Just give me a bit more time. Give me a bit more time. Yeah, right, here we go. I'm curious when, you know, like, when it came out on the radio, if, like, obviously now, like, people do radio edits and stuff. If I, you know, I don't, obviously, I was born in 1987, so I never heard this on the radio at the time when it came out. I'm curious if they just played it from the front or
they
if
did.
They just cuts.
So
did they?
I remember buying it on 7-inch and yeah, there's no edit of that. It does start like that. Interestingly, my lasting memory of buying that on 7-inch is the fact that Europe, that obviously were very much sort of hair metal, but they had the worst hair metal haircuts. And and I remember I'd sit there looking at the sleeve, and the game I'll play in my head was, if I had to have one of these shit haircuts, which one would I have? And I'd literally just be looking at the five members of Europe thinking, I'd probably have to go with that one, but it is really bad. That's my lasting memory of my 7-inch single of Europe. Which one of their shit haircuts would I entertain if I had to?
I mean, you know, it was obviously people were vibing with that haircut, you know. It wasn't only Europe doing it, and yeah, it's just funny. Like, I think you know, it's like melodically is like so strong, and even if you're probably out now and somebody just puts that record on, you're like, what? No. And then it's just suddenly like, get, I don't know.
It's weird though, isn't it? Yeah. How like, because the 80s is like the golden era of synth pop and the playover. And it's really weird because Europe, with everything they looked like, and, you know, this I believe they were German, weren't they? And this kind of rock band. But essentially, it's just a synth pop record, isn't it? You know, that playover could
totally.
Quite easily
yeah.
be Take On Me or Just Can't Get Enough. You know, it's just
a
synth pop track, but just fronted by five blokes with poodle haircuts. Like,
yeah, but also his vocal is actually like, you know, you try singing along to that, it's like a super high tenor part that he's screaming out. You know, it's nothing to be sniffed at.
Yeah, it's an 80s, you know? It's a stone cold classic. And as soon as you hear that synth play over to this day, it's like, right, let's start fist pumping. It's got me. Like, it's a cracker. Okay. I'm going to ask you for track two, please, Bob.
You're
I'm
on it, yeah.
To tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
I was born in 1987, so we're kind of the age where things have started to have an emotional impact on you, probably about 9-10 years old sort of thing. And I'll have to admit, it was Viva Forever by the Spice Girls, which is pretty embarrassing, but you know, it's kind of funny actually, because this track, even now I might be at a house party and this track comes on, it's just like, oh yeah, like there's a yearning. And it's like, I think it was, you know, like, albeit how cheesy it is, it's got this harmony. I just remember the first time I heard it, I just couldn't get enough of it. I was like, that is lush. And you know, and it,
what was the emotion?
Being of the 90s, the emotion, I mean, it's just sort of longing for, well, when I hear it, it's that kind of, longing for something, and there's a yearning. And I wouldn't say it's sad. It's just like kind of maybe remembering about. So when I hear it now, which is ridiculous because we're talking about the Spice Girls, you know, it sort of brings back memories of me being younger listening to this track. And I remember the first time I just had it on like mini disc player, and I just played it on repeat. And I think I was also at that age, you know, I was sort of starting to write music and I was learning a lot of music, and I was really obsessed with harmony. And that track starts in, and it's just has this really kind of breathy, airy quality to it. I was also learning classical guitar, and this has like was in the era of a classical nylon guitar solo,
yeah,
you know, when they were so popular, you know, even in like Backstreet Boys always had a nylon classical guitar solo. It's strange, you know, there are so many tracks out there, but I just remember this one, and it you know, I was so young. And and it, you know, it is quite cinematic, I think, as a song, in terms of if you were you could probably get like a choral version of that song,
yeah,
you know, or like you could play it in a string orchestra at, you know, and it completely reimagine that song and take it quite seriously. I think it sounds crazy, but I could imagine that sort of working.
Yeah, absolutely. And those sort of early years of your life, like where were they? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Staffordshire. I'm from a place called Lichfield, which is a city, and it's a very, very small city, sort of outside of Birmingham, near Tamworth, which is maybe even more. Well, it's interesting because Lichfield is so small, and the only reason why it's a city is because it has a cathedral. Mm-hmm. It's quite well known, and so I grew up. I was there for the first sort of 18 years of my life before, you know, going to uni and coming down here to London. And all my family, it was sort of Derbyshire and Nottingham. And this sort of specific time I remember listening to this song on repeat was on a journey back from visiting my cousins who were in Nottingham. It's like a 45-minute journey. Just was like, had the single on mini disc player. It wasn't a mini disc. It was, sorry, Discman.
You had to literally hold it level, otherwise it'd skip. Like, you just had
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I remember that even happening. And it was like the car went over a bump and it went, and you'd hear it scraping. It was just, it's funny. Like, as I said, it's sort of thinking about these questions, like first response. And first one that came to my mind. And but it is like, I think it's just quite a lush track.
And so, sort of growing up in Staffordshire, home, like, what was it a musical place?
I went to, like, the school that I went to was Lichfield Cathedral School, and there, you know, they had a choir and music was always around, but music was very much always in my family. I wouldn't have said that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I wouldn't have said Lichfield was a hub of music.
No,
outburst.
Was there records at home? Was there instruments in the house growing up?
Oh yeah, totally, yeah. So you know, my dad, he plays guitar, and you know, that sort of motivated me to learn how to play guitar because I saw him always playing it.
Sure.
My dad's dad, so my granddad, he played like 7 instruments. And so, and he was an engineer as well. He used to work in radio and just sort of fix things just for fun. He played like saxophone and guitar, the range of, I think he was, I didn't really know him that well, but I was told, he just would find instruments and learn how to play it. And then on my other side, my mum's mum, she played piano. And so it was always there, and every Christmas or every sort of family gathering, like my sister learned to play flute and piano, and my cousins were learning guitar and cello. Like, you know, there's a lot of music going on, and it was always like, I'm the youngest out of a lot. And we'd always have like sort of little family concerts, you know, even if that was sort of me on the saxophone playing along to My Heart Will Go On to a CD, doing a saxophone rendition. I remember actually, when after sort of, I guess, reception is what it is, and when you kind of start, I guess, proper school, I remember that you kind of, right, you know, it's a time to sort of, you can learn an instrument. I was sort of age 7, I think, or 6 or 7. And I was like, I'd love to play guitar and drums, you know, because at that age, everyone wants to be in a band.
Yeah.
And I sort of specifically remember my parents going, guitar, fine. Drums? Maybe not drums. And I understand why, because they're very loud. But also, what is really funny is that, so I started playing guitar first, and then maybe a year or two later, but it was classical guitar, actually. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of rock guitar or acoustic. So I was, you know, learning notation and finger picking. Then I was like, I want to learn saxophone because my granddad plays saxophone. And I learned on I sort of inherited his original saxophone. It was like silver. And but for some reason, and I don't know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What it is, but I remember when I was wanted to learn, and the school were like, okay, that's great, first recorder. I'm like, why do I have to learn recorder? It was like this rite of passage. I swear, like, you'll ask anyone, I can't play an instrument, but I did do a grade on recorder. It's like, I don't know why we had to do that.
It's still
either
the most
that
horrific
or like
group
violin sessions,
I think, known to man, the recorder. It's like squealing recorders at my primary school. That noise will forever haunt me. Three blind mice being played all over the place. Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. That and also group lessons of the violin at a very younger age. I mean, I just never quite understood a group lesson at the violin, and I married that with beginner recorder. I mean, that's a band that probably not want to go and see. You know, it was like music was kind of always there, and we had a clavinova in the house, and you know, the piano was the last instrument that I picked up, and I was trying to sort of, my sister played piano, so it was there, and I was trying to dabble with it and try to figure it out and trying to actually sort of write music before knowing how to play piano. And it was a clavinova, so you could I remember you could press a button and it have like a whole backing track where when you hit the root notes, it would change chords. Yeah. And then the upper half, you could choose an instrument out of the array and then play like a melody. And so you could, and it had like four controls on it, like the bass and the mids and the trebles and all, like the kind of more melodic instruments or the percussion. And I remember, like, with floppy disk, making my own little mixes of writing stuff where it's just simply me just kind of moving the roots down and playing something, but then like changing the levels of, gonna hold the bass back and I'm gonna bring the drums in. I was like eight or nine years old at this time, and then I sort of vaguely remember thinking or asking my parents, could I learn to actually play piano, like have proper lessons, because I was having this desire to write music. And you know, I had guitar at the time, and I wasn't really playing songs. I mean, actually, it's quite funny because I was learning classical guitar, and every time we went to a party, everyone's like, oh yeah, play Wonderwall. I'm like, I don't know, I can play you classical gas. And
you know, not now, thanks,
it was
Paul.
Like a different world. yeah exactly. and it's even like, what knee, you know, when you learn classical, the guitar is always on your left knee. Yeah. Whereas you see most people playing acoustics on songs, always on the right knee. A bit more casual. And so strangely, kind of playing more sort of poppy stuff and kind of really only happened in my second school. Yeah. And I kind of, because I didn't have a steel string, I was on nylon.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not really the same unless you're playing Jose Gonzalez.
Absolutely.
And at the time I didn't know who that was, you know, but that is also a beautiful vibe.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah, so it was very sort of classical, and also strangely, the saxophone, learning Baroque pieces on a saxophone. Yeah. I could never get my head around that. I'm like, why am I playing a Baroque piece on the saxophone? The saxophone, like these two eras were so far apart. And but you know, it kind of absorbs you. It kind of makes you aware of all these different styles and what can be done. So yeah, a long answer, but yes,
not at all. But you know, throughout the answer, you alluded to school several times. So let's ask about that. So for track three, tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please, Paul.
So I'd have to say it's a track by John Mayer, the brilliant John Mayer, called "Body Is a Wonderland," and in secondary school, it was on his Room for Squares album. And we just, like all of us, I think, probably like when we were kind of toward our latter years of secondary school, just that album, we were all listening to it. And that track, there's a really beautiful lyric in "My Body is a Wonderland." And it's like, I'll never let your head hit the bed without my hand behind it. And it was like the way it kind of happens. There's something kind of it's just a great, like, it's an unconventional chord sequence, and just like his vocal is great, and I mean that whole album is great, but it was really sort of with me, and a lot of us actually just listen to that track over and over again. And so when it comes on now, it gives an element of nostalgia.
Yeah.
Of, because I feel like your latter years of school, you kind of go through school feeling like, well, I know I did, or you're like, oh God, school. And it's like, feel a bit arduous. But toward the latter end, you start, you're kind of 16, 17, 18, teachers are taking you more seriously, or you're becoming an adult, and you're really sort of, really enjoying, and you're narrowing your subjects and really kind of seeing where you're going to go. And they're very happy memories. And so every time this track comes on, it always reminds me of those sort of latter years of school.
When you was at school, did you want to be a composer? Was that always a focus for you? And was that encouraged and supported?
Yeah. So, before I went to school, I was sort of trying to write song, like soppy ballads on piano and stuff. And I was writing a lot of songs in some bands. As a guy I used to write with, we kind of wrote songs together, but we'd also write instrumental music. It was always there. And I kind of around 15, 16-ish, I'd already had, like, my parents had a basement. They lived the house is kind of slightly Scandinavian in a way, but they have this basement, and that was where my studio would be even at that age. And I had this 10 track recorder where you could just sort of bounce down. And I remember doing my GCSEs and basically sort of recording it all down there, tracking myself up, rather than it providing at the time you have to do a Sibelius file. And I was just really into it and just wanted to make my own music. And even then, I was obsessed with film music, and it was kind of something I wanted to do. And I was writing the instrumental music that I was writing. I wasn't at that time writing it to any picture particularly, but it sort of felt like film music, like, because it wasn't classical. It was sort of more modern than that. It's one of those things where, of course, at that age, like, I loved writing music, and I just thought, how is that going to be possible? And I was thinking, I can't do that. And my parents were like, wow, like, even writing piano pieces, my parents were like, wow, it sounds really filmic, and film was very much a part of my life. So my dad is a director of photographer, and so at a very young age, he's working on these dramas, and I was going along to on set, not at that time really realizing, the sort of gravitas of that, and learning, or just seeing how things kind of go. Sure. And so cinematography is always that marriage and seeing music to picture. And so it was kind of, it was really encouraged. And I just sort of loved music lessons. I just loved doing composition, and it was just loved to escape. And it was kind of an outlet. And because I was learning saxophone as well, and I was in a jazz band, and obviously with that, if jazz, it's a lot of improvisation. And so that again is just another form of composition, but happening in the moment.
Sure.
And so, it was always encouraged. And and it, you know, sort of morphed as I kind of grew older. And definitely when I got to uni, when you suddenly meet like-minded people, because there was only I think four people in my A-level music class, and so it's kind of a narrow field. And then suddenly you find more people that want to write music with a film. And then it becomes like, oh, maybe I can do this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then at uni, you just kind of keep pushing and find out a way to do that.
I want to pick up on that journey in a moment, but I'm feeling that we're starting to kind of teeter into talking about really interesting, credible music. So just to kind of get the balance right, if we talk about the first song you remember buying from a record store now, we should be able to restore a little bit of balance.
Oh yeah, I know. It's so funny. I'm gonna add, this was on cassette. So excited. I've got I think it was like £1.99 or £2.99. First cassette, first record, Gina G, who are just a little bit. It's funny because I remember getting this record and putting it on, and I had to when I was thinking of this, and I was like, I'm going to listen to this track again because I'd not probably heard it for 20 years or something. That was my first record. It's funny, I'm sure you probably it's so embarrassing because you probably, you know, interview people who were born in the 70s and they got really cool answers,
No. Do you know what? This is the question that always delivers, because, you know, if you've got one of the Foo Fighters on it or whoever it is, they will then just still go, oh yeah, God, yeah, I bought this. And it's like, everybody knows this is a safe space to announce your first record, because I don't subscribe to that thing that there's any 10-year-olds that are listening to obscure indie records, you know, you know, it's just not happening. Come on.
No.
Our first records are meant to be shit. To be pure bubblegum pop records that are just
totally
earworms that you love. So don't worry, mate, you're in a safe space.
It's funny. But you know, it's like, you know, got to give it to that record. It's pretty catchy, you know.
Really hooky, catchy.
You know, and it's like, I mean, that is the beauty of pop records. And, you know, it is actually I remember being, when I was younger, writing music, trying to, you know, you go through that sort of, anti-conformist sort of period where oh, I'm going to write extended rounds of 16 chord sequences and make it really complicated, something, and come across some magical sequence that no one has ever used. And then trying to write something that's hooky along to that, it's just like near impossible. And then you kind of go back, and even now it's like, I'll be listening to some pop records and be like, wow, that's really good. And it's really hard to nail that simplicity, you know,
100%.
Taking Mr. Brightside, you know, what a tune that is. The melody really doesn't deviate very much, but it's just everything surrounds that. It's the key, I think, you know, it's hard to sort of do a pop song well. And so they definitely mustn't be sort of made any less credit of anything, because they are you know, superb. And but I think, you know, it's so it's funny, especially at that age. It's
100%. Sort of, to write the perfect pop song, he's one of them. Obviously, it's the one of the hardest things to do in the world. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have spent forever and a day trying to do that. And he's, I had the Killers on the podcast, and the guitarist that wrote that, and I asked him what his favourite intro was, and I don't know what he said, but I was like, dude, you wrote the intro to Mr. Brightside.
Yeah, but he said his own tune.
You should literally be banging on about yourself right now, you know, because you wherever you're at, a festival or a family party or a nightclub, whatever genre is being played, you hear that guitar lick at the beginning, shit's going to go
totally
off, because it's just perfect. And wonderful. Well, I want to pick back up on your journey now, and what I'm interested in is somebody that sort of in the 90s pursued the route of indie band and recording demos and, you know, traipsing around Camden trying to find, you know, different labels and pushing a demo in their hands and things like that. Has the route to establishing yourself in the world of film scores and composition, like how does that, because I imagine it's a very different way of doing it than going out and playing to two men and a dog on a Wednesday night at a, you know, the back room of a pub in Camden. It's so give me a bit more of an insight into how you start to sort of move through the ranks to ultimately find yourself scoring the most beautiful thing that's on television at the moment. And
thank you.
and so give me a little bit of an insight into sort of how you progress and establish yourself in that arena.
You know, like, there isn't a right way. You know, everyone has their own journey. I think, like, for me, like, obviously I started off, and I think when I could get into, like, post-production houses, and I was handing my CV around, and then I soon realized that is not the best way to do it, because then I'd end up just being stuck in a post-production house. And I didn't really know the best way, but at uni, my tutor, he was telling me, you know, he knew that I wanted to write music for film and take it seriously as a career, and he told me about a composer who at the time was scoring Stardust, and I was like, wow, yeah. He tutored him 10 years before, and he passed on details, and we kind of connected a little bit while I was at uni, but I was still studying, so, you know, nothing really happened. And then I suddenly then realized that, right, that's how I need to get in somehow, you know, and work underneath someone, if that sort of thing existed. And now that I feel is like the best path to kind of get in to sort of, it's not everyone's route, but for me, that was kind of how it happened. And but it didn't happen like overnight, you know, that I was still at uni, and then after graduating, it's like a year by, and then I was kind of going back to other routes by trying to find short films. Like, there was a website called Mandy.com, and people just post looking for composers. You know, these are like free things, and just to sort of try and gain that experience, make friends within the industry, because you're sort of, you know, 21 years old. Trying to meet other directors that were in the same position as me, but as a director. So everyone's really trying to make something of themselves, and I found that quite useful, actually, kind of making a few mistakes in terms of, like, learning how to sort of write music to a picture and adhere to those things. But really, for me, it happened when, then like a year later, I saw, he turned out to be my mentor, a composer called Ilan Ashkeri, and he came up to Leeds. And so I studied in Leeds, and he came up, and he was doing a talk, and I was like, right, I need to stay. And I know that everyone's going to be doing the same. As soon as this talk ends, everyone's going to be on him like a moth to a flame. And I was like, right, I'm going to try and muscle my way to the front of this crowd and be like, hey, do you remember me? We spoke like a year and a half ago over email. And he was like, yeah, I do, actually. And so I think he put a note on his, like, a reminder and to kind of contact me. And then he sort of walked off and everyone else was like, oh, what? and you know, that just kind of comes with being determined of just like, right, this has got an objective. And I, you know, I had no money really at this time, you know, and I wasn't living in Leeds, I was living in Lichfield. So just coming up specifically for this with a goal in mind. And then, yeah, like a month or so later, getting a call saying, oh, when are you moving down to London, you know, what's your plan? And I was just like, look, you know, whenever opportunity presents itself. And so he called me on a Saturday night and I'm like, okay, just give me 5 minutes. And so then I called up my best mates who I studied with, who his family home was in London. And he said to me, you know, if anything happens, if you need somewhere to stay, I think he was talking on the behalf of his parents, if you need to crash on a sofa, just let me know. And so I was like, right, I'm going to use that. I'm going to call him. And I said, I got this phone call. I was like, yeah, sure. And so the Monday morning, literally like less than 48 hours later, just took a suitcase, came down to London. I think I went straight to the studio where they were working at. And Elon was working on Kick-Ass and Coriolanus at the time. So me being like 22 years old, coming in, seeing like these big movies and the process going on, I was a bit like, yeah, this is where I need to be. You know, like, so I just started off basically being a runner, and it was just travel expenses paid at the time, because, you know, there was no like interview process particularly. Sure. It was just you know, you kind of are presented those opportunities, and then it's like, okay, I'll find moments where I can show what I can do, and then you gradually get given more responsibility. And so for me, I just was always making sure that I never left. I waited till Elan, like, he would often be the last one to leave. It's like, I can't go before that. I have to just try to always be around, because I got nowhere to be.
Yeah.
I had no money. I didn't know anyone in London. What's the point of me going home? I've got nothing else to do.
Sure.
And so, yeah. And I just kind of learned under, there's a lot of work going in there. And I was also working and learning like production sort of recording techniques. Because Elan worked with the score producer called Steve McLaughlin, who, you know, produced the scores for Heat and worked a lot with Michael Kamen and Lethal Weapons and like huge movies. And so you've kind of got all this talent and learning, sort of learning kind of firsthand, whilst also sort of being at the beginning, yeah, of fly on the wall and doing all that stuff. And so, you know, that's kind of how I think a lot of composers now have sort of taken that route. But then, yeah, there's obviously people doing the artist route, where they're sort of, as you said, you know, may even be playing to two people, you know, their own instrumental music. And obviously now there's a wealth of instrumental music and sort of piano instrumental music and quite filmic music, and people making their own records, and even like, you know, artists like Ben Frost, who make really cool like electronic modern music, but then go and score something like Dark, you know, where the two worlds are colliding. So, you know, like, my method, there's no right way, but that's how it happened for me anyway.
Okay, well, we'll jump back on that after the next track. So for this track, which is number 5, I'm gonna ask you to tell me the song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Great tune, Insomnia by Faithless. I mean, as soon as you hear that, the synth riff that comes up on that, it's just like, yeah, like, everyone knows. Even actually, you could probably just hear the chime, the clock chime, and everyone knows what tune is coming up. Yeah. And it is really cinematic as well, you know.
Euphoric,
it has this sort of, it is euphoric, yeah. And it's, you know, especially when
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I don't know, during the verses, you're just kind of lost in it, and it's just a great track, and it was always so silly. I'd remembering back to university and clubbing, and as soon as this track came on, everyone's like holding a C with their hand going chewed. It's just like, you know, and it, you know, it brings like a lot of fun memories, but it is just, it's euphoric, it's cinematic, it's epic.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, when you was talking about you know, artists that, and for me, for somebody that comes from a more sort of, I guess, traditional band approach to the industry, seeing the sort of crossover in artists, I guess like Sigur Rós, that were, you know, playing live gigs as a band,
totally,
as such,
yeah.
But then the music being used and scored on wildlife documentaries and all sorts, and and I guess with bands and stuff like that, when I was reading some stuff about you, you've ended up working with multiple Indian rock bands, right?
Yeah. And that sort of, it's happened a lot. And I feel like it's when it happens the first time, then suddenly, if it happens again, then it starts to become a sort of, not a signature, but like a trait that people know that you can do. And it's like where you're wearing your producer hat a little bit. And, you know, I love it. And I love collaborating and with different people musically, because you can sort of, especially in the film world, it can be quite a solitary sort of life. You're in your studio writing music and you have your own set way of doing it. But working with all these different artists and bands, bringing their know-how and the way they do things to the table, it's like, wow, it sort of opens up your mind. And you know, and it kind of, to be honest, a lot of it started through when I was working with Ilan and Steve. And Steve McLaughlin, he's a producer. And so there was a film called London Boulevard where Serge Fukasabian came in, and, you know, that was his first sort of film project. But I was assisting and working with them and understanding how to form that dialogue, and I guess how to get the best out of someone in that situation. The same goes for Badger John Boy, you know, and it's like a different, there's a different sort of, I don't know, there's a different language sometimes. And sometimes you just find out the most interesting way of doing something that they, you know, creating a sound, or was purely they did this method because it was what they had to hand, you know? And it's like, wow, yeah, totally. That's genius. And then it's sort of, you know, these relationships kind of, you get introduced to someone else. And so I was working with Guy Garvey and on a variety of projects, and Peter Jobson. And then you became friends, and you, the end product is very different from if you were sort of left to your own devices, or if I was just doing it, or if the artist was just doing it by themselves, you know. Yeah. You kind of, two worlds come together. And so, you know, most recently collaborating with Grime producer Swindle on Champion, that was a very, you know, different sort of world to what I was used to. You know, probably the furthest musically away from where I've ever kind of worked in.
How was that?
And I was super nervous at the beginning because I just thought, how is this going to work? And, you know, and then I just had a step back and just thought, you know, I'm just going to do the same thing I normally do. And, you know, we just sat down right at the beginning when we were working, got to know each other. And, you know, we realized that we were basically born sort of 2 weeks apart, and we were telling our sort of stories of growing up, and we were almost living in this parallel sort of world. Him in his basement making grime beats, trying to flog CDs, me writing singer-songwriter tunes, trying to flog CDs to my mates, you know, doing the same thing but in two very different worlds. And and sort of the kind of understanding that happens there, and, you know, and you sort of I think the most difficult thing is both opening up and just allowing both styles to infuse. Yeah. And so on that project, it's kind of really interesting because we were sort of talking how we feel like we created this subgenre of cinematic grime and R&B, you know, like instrumental.
Yeah.
With, you know, and where there's not really a lot of that around, and sort of being kind of bringing what I know as score and playing to the scene, but how to sort of bring his background and make those two worlds collide. So it was really interesting. And even down to sort of like what musicians are using, you know, like it really needed to have the Swindle sound. And so I was like, okay, yeah, well, you have to use the musicians that you always use because, you know, that's part of it, and certain production techniques. And so it's, yeah, and it was like I learned so much, and in that world, and it's like when you start to know the ingredients and understand that, and it opens up your mind, I think. But yeah, so it was great. I was nervous at the beginning, but then and now, you know, and then you make great friends as well, and so, you know, we're that's what music does, you know. You kind of when you're creating in that environment and you're vibing off each other and you're buzzing, and it's, you know, it's sort of like great friendships can sort of happen in those moments.
Fantastic. I'm going to take you home for track 6 and ask you to tell me the favorite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Yeah. So I had to do some research on this because I was trying to find who was from Staffordshire, and hopefully this counts, but Robert Plant was from Staffordshire, and he obviously part of Led Zeppelin. So I thought, oh, Immigrant Song, that's a great tune. Yeah. You know, again, great intro.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and feel like I kind of keep picking really cinematic style tracks, because I think they used that on the opening of The Girl with the Dragon, that movie where they made The Girl with Dragon Tattoo. I think they may have even hyped it up a bit, but it's just like, that rhythm is just, I don't know. Yeah. Everything about it, you know, it's this driving feeling. Yeah. And it's,
it thunders along as well. Doesn't it?
No, it does. And it's kind of slightly psychedelic and slightly, alluring in a way,
yeah,
especially with that vocal, and a bit haunting as well.
Absolutely. Well, before we move on to your final track, I want you to tell me a little bit about Earth, and because for anybody that's listening to this that hasn't watched it yet, it's spectacular, absolutely spectacular, and the work that you've done on it is, in my opinion, a very important part of that and a key part of that, and it tracks it beautifully. Tell me a little bit about how that come about.
So it was one of these projects that, you know, like, I have to be honest, it was a dream project. And it, you know, I've always been interested in shows like The Planets and Universe, and knowing, like, finding out how we came to be, you know, those bigger questions. And one 2019, December, this email pops up in my inbox, and this rarely happens in this way, from BBC Studios. And you know, I've done previous work with BBC Studios, trying being an example, which is very different from Earth, you know. And but it pops up, say, hey, are you interested in working on this project? It's called Earth. And they sent me the like a little document explaining what it's going to be. The front page, just a picture of our Earth, entitled Earth. And I thought, I just looked at that and thought, yeah, that I don't need to read anymore. This looks amazing. And just knowing their previous work, and it was just sort of like, I knew that it was gonna have this expanse, and they'd had all the scripts from all the episodes. I think at that time they had filmed the first episode. You know, this process is such a long process, and like 2.5 years or so, and I was on it for about 18 or 19 months, and so it came through, and I had a phone call with the showrunner, and we talked about ideas of what I think the score could be. You know, we talked very heavily the fact that a show like this is a huge amount of visual effects that are artificially recreated, creating these other worlds that are, you know, unknown to us, places that, you know, we would never, you know, we weren't there. We don't know what it sounds like. And so it was important for me to try to somehow combine. Obviously, you're going to have these huge orchestral sweeping sort of tropes that these shows need, and take you on this emotive journey with all these sort of tensions and releases that occur. But then I really wanted to bring as many sounds from our Earth as possible by sort of having the combination of these found sounds and making otherworldly sounds from everyday things, making a sort of backing textures. So you've got the orchestra, but then up on that, you've got this whole other world going on, and you know, and everything needed to be real. And even with the orchestra, you know, it was, you know, it's going to be hugely symphonic, and that needed to be live, and all these things to give the score a grounding where, you know, just to sort of give a realism to, obviously you're looking at the effects. So how can we create a sort of human or a sort of realness to it? And that was kind of the concept, I guess. And I think having all these different time periods, you've got sort of snowball when the earth was trapped in snow, you've got green when the plants and soil was being created, inferno, all these different things. And I also thought it was going to be, you know, I wanted to give each episode a unique tone in terms of, like, for example, in green, with a lot of, amongst all the sort of quite pastoral music there, I sort of tracked a lot of just a cello, creating these kind of woody organic textures on there just to kind of make it feel a little bit more organic. And then for like Snowball, a lot of it shot in Iceland, give everything this icy sort of glass-like feeling, otherworldly vocals and metallic scraping noise, you know, things again just to sort of transport from an auditory point of view the viewer to that place, and with each episode try to do that, but whilst also having sort of strong melodic material and a sort of central theme that I would call like the earth theme, that kind of comes back but in these different states, or I mean implying it, either just using the harmony, and it's sort of, yeah, I mean it's such a grand show, and you know, kind of you know, again, these things have helped to sort of make things feel more immersive as well, you know? And it's and like I was always you know, I think our Earth is such a wonderful thing, and like how one of the music to also kind of give this sense of awe and wonder. And there's certain things by, you know, without getting too technical, but in the harmony, using quite sort of classical-esque progressions, but then just flipping that on its head with this whole modern onset of, you know, like otherworldly sounds and vocals and electric guitars. I thought they will go, the guitars are always going to represent lava.
Yeah,
volcanoes, you know, metal guitars and distorted sounds morphed, and you know, combining all these things, giving everything this whole, like, you know, I don't know, yeah, just giving it like this sort of cohesive sound of this otherworldly place. And so all these ideas floating about, it just was it ended up just being a joy to work on, and a lot of work.
That was incredible work, because the show is absolutely fantastic. And for those that haven't seen it yet, head over to the BBC iPlayer, and I'm sure it'll be in the ones to watch, because it's a huge show, and it's an incredible show, and I urge you all to go and explore it. Final track. And I'm going to ask you now, please, Paul, to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to go and listen to.
So, I came across this song kind of recently, and it was actually whilst working on Earth. And it's a very difficult question, this, because it's like so many songs, like how to find something that not many people have heard. And I think this is relatively unknown, and it's quite cinematic. It's a song called Looks. And it's by a guy called Volk Greg Lerman. And it, you know, the front half of it is basically like a score track. Mm-hmm. And then this vocal comes in that you're not expecting. And it's kind of almost in that Woodkid sort of vibe, you know, cinematic and epic and not really pop or anything. And when I heard it, I thought, wow, I love the sort of synergy and the fact that you've combined this hugely cinematic intro and then going into a song in a way that like a lot of modern trailer music is doing, but this is like just existing as its own thing. And I just think it's a really cool track.
It's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. The vocals are beautiful as well. I don't know who that is. But it's a beautiful track. And we make it easy, Paul, for people to go and check that out, because we put together a little Spotify playlist with that on it. And all of the tracks that we've spoken about today. So as we start to sort of wind the episode down, post-Earth, I mean, that's a strange way to put it, I guess.
Post-Earth,
when you're done with Earth, what's coming up? What's next, mate?
So I am just finishing two projects, actually, at the moment, and one of which is a sequel. I did the first one, and it is the sequel to Your Christmas or Mine. On Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. First movie came out last Christmas, so I've just literally yesterday finished the mixing. We recorded that, and then now just also finishing a project called Fight or Flight, which is like an American action comedy starring Josh Hartnett. Very different from Your Christmas or Mine. Yeah. And pretty fun, you know. And then I'm about to begin on season 4 of Apple TV's Trying, which is the sort of lovely sort of bittersweet family drama it kind of keeps on going, but it's just so heartfelt and warming. Yeah. The characters are so endearing. You just, it almost writes itself.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
Paul, if people want to keep up to speed with everything that you're doing and your output, where's the best place to stay up to speed on everything you're doing?
So I have a website, just literally www.paulsaunderson.com. Obviously, I have a Spotify page where I try to release as much music as I can. And You know, I have the Music of Earth, our soundtrack's coming out. It's going to be August 22nd, which will also have the song that we wrote with Sipo. So yeah, that's coming out. And yeah, I think those are probably the best two places, to be honest. And I'm on Instagram as well. So I always try to, I tend to post more on Instagram. Well, there's so many social medias out there. I find it very difficult to keep up on posting in all the different places. Sure. Like, I'm not on TikTok. I feel maybe I should be, but yeah, Instagram is a good place. And that's just my name, Paul Saunderson.
Wonderful. Well, we'll tag you in it when this episode comes out. So if people aren't following you already, then they can go and do so.
Great.
Paul, it's been a real delight talking records with you. Thank you so much for your time today, mate. It's been lovely.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on. It's been really fun.
Absolute pleasure. I'm going to press stop. Don't go anywhere. There you go. Oh, that was a lovely chat. Paul was such a top fella, and we had a big old chat afterwards, and we was talking. We talked a bit of Zimmer, and we talked we talked some of our favourite scores, and obviously we mentioned Ludovico and This Is England, the scoring of that, and yeah, it was just they're always the good ones when you press stop at the end and you just stick about and just keep chatting so I hope you enjoyed that. Like I say, I've not really been sort of super heavy on the composers on previous episodes, but it's such an interesting, you know, road to that side of you know, of the music industry. So it was lovely to kind of pick his brains, and then to find out about the work that he's done with so many indie bands. And he was humble there as well. There's some much, much bigger names in there. Go and check out his story on his website and on Wikipedia. He's worked with some huge, huge acts. And yeah, he was just being a little bit humble there. Anyway, thanks ever so much for listening. Go check out that back catalogue now. There's hundreds and hundreds of episodes all to be listened to for free. And if you enjoyed that and you'd like to support the podcast, you can just click on the show notes. There's a thing called Buy Me a Coffee, and you can just click that and buy me a coffee. Or you can head over and pay your 70p and become a Patreon and support the podcast that way and get access to loads of other fun stuff. Like I said at the beginning, offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. In the meantime, be nice to each other. Thanks again for listening. Love you. Bye-bye.